Hello, and welcome to The Big Snore. In each episode, I will read a passage from a book, an article, a magazine that runs about 15 to 20 minutes. You can choose to listen to this as a bedtime story, or just a story at any time of the day. Today, the book I'm reading from is Janice P. Nomura's title, Daughters of the Samurai, A Journey from East to West and Back. The babies arrived in due course. Ume's new sister Tomi that summer, Sudamatsu's firstborn daughter Hisako in November, and Shige's second child, a boy named Takeo, in early spring. As she approached her 20th birthday, Ume wrote a contemplative Christmas letter to Georgetown. On the whole, I'm glad this year, 84, is most gone, she mused. I had so much to worry about, trying to teach Miss Ito and endeavoring to do my best in my ignorance of Japanese customs and language. Yes, it was hard, and I'm glad it is over. I hope the next year will somehow be better and smoother, and that my way will be clearer. Shige and Sudamatsu were mothers now, their hands and minds full of responsibilities that Ume did not share. But before 1885 was over, Ume's life would be consumed with a comparably momentous event, the birth of a school. In September, ending months of delay and doubt, a scroll arrived at the Suda home in Azabu, directing Ume to present herself at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning at the Imperial Household Ministry, accompanied by a relative, to receive her appointment as a founding member of the faculty at the new Peeress's School. I must say that paragraph, accompanied by a relative, was most thoughtfully put in, for it is not customary, Ume wrote, and I had been on pins and needles wondering how in the world I was to get along at all, alone to get my appointment, and my Japanese far from perfect. Dressed in her best blue silk and with her father by her side, she threaded the hallways of the ministry and received the precious documents that made her an employee of the Meiji government, hired to teach English with a salary of 420 yen annually, and the bureaucratic rank of Jun Sonin. Shige, she was quick to point out to Mrs. Landman, held the lower rank of Hanin in her position at the government music school. Accompanied by Utako Shimoda, who was appointed directress of the new school, Ume spent the rest of the day paying calls on the Hirobumi, Ito, and all the officials who had a part in her hiring. When, exhausted, she returned to Azabu at last, she found her home in an uproar. Her father had spread the good news in her absence, and all the relatives had arrived. We had quite a grand dinner in honor of the day, and I received congratulations from all around on my appointment, especially on the rank, she reported with pride. At least for the moment, all the doubts and frustration of the preceding years receded. I have my papers and am now a teacher in the School of the Empress. Classes at the Peeress's School, or Kazoku Jokaku, began on the 5th of October. Ume was pleased with her new surroundings, especially the faculty room. I have such a nice desk here, a great big one in the farthest part of the room by the window, where it is light and pleasant. It is indeed the place of honor in this room, and it is the best place, she boasted to Mrs. Landman. Without much to occupy her, and somewhat uncomfortable among her new colleagues, she wrote at unusual length to her foster mother that week. It gave her an excuse to sit at her new desk and look professional. She taught only 3 hours each day, and her scholars were somewhat distracted. Everyone's attention was focused instead on the upcoming opening exercises at the school, which the Empress herself would attend. Ume found the rehearsals tiresome, and the prospect of the actual ceremony filled her with dread. I know just how I ought to do, but I'm afraid I will lose my head and be put out. Forget the many signals and not put the girls through the proper forms, she worried. It's just like me to stare blankly when the signal is made and forget my part before so many. The little sprite who had blithely recited the white-footed deer before her elementary school classmates was no longer so sure of herself. In Georgetown, each accomplishment had made her a minor celebrity. Among the elite of etiquette-obsessed Tokyo, every public appearance was an opportunity for her to fail. On the day of the ceremony, Ume dressed carefully in gold brocade gown made specially for the occasion. My dress really did look nice, and it was praised as being very handsome, though it did not cost so much really as it seemed, Umi wrote, tempering her satisfaction with a show of pragmatism, as befitted a working woman. It had a long train to it, and I felt very dignified with it sweeping about. The Empress arrived in a grand carriage, followed by a procession of smaller conveyances containing her ladies-in-waiting. Before Umi had a chance to ask about protocol, she was summoned to make her bow. Though the setting was now a girls' school classroom rather than an imposing palace audience chamber, the 20-year-old American-educated teacher who stood before her sovereign that morning felt very much like the bewildered, kimono-clad 6-year-old she had once been. I did not know what to do, and I'm sure I did not do it right, but I walked in without any instruction and bowed 3 times, as I believe must be done, she wrote. But as I had to hold down my head, bow, and come out, I could not see where the Empress was, nor how she looked at all. After the Empress had made the rounds of the various classes, the entire school gathered in the assembly hall, joined by an audience of illustrious guests. Umi took her place with the faculty in front of the long rows of girls. Sutemitsu, now the Countess Oyama, stood to one side with the court ladies and others of noble rank. General Oyama had been raised to the rank of count by the Peerage Act of 1884, which conferred titles on non-nobles who had been of unusual service to Japan. Countess is a very empty title, as Sutemitsu herself said, and most absurd, but nevertheless hers in right, and that is what she has to be called in truth, Umi had written with poorly disguised envy. It all sounds very fine, it seems to me, in name at least, and it may have some effect on the Europeans at any rate. A band played. After the music ceased, the Empress arose and read something, of which I understood only a little, reported Umi, but it spoke of the education of women and the necessity of schools, urging both teachers and scholars to work upward. Had Umi more perfectly comprehended the Empress's words, she might have felt less approving. Though the Empress had progressed to reading her own speeches rather than expressing them through an intermediary, she was hardly a progressive. We consider women's duty is to possess the virtues of obsequiousness, to attend to their parents as well as to their fathers-in-law and mothers-in-law, assist their husbands, to conduct their family affairs properly, and, when they become mothers, to give their children home instruction. The Empress had exhorted the assembled daughters of the nobility that afternoon. To qualify themselves for these, they must acquire a proper knowledge of things. Scholarship would assist these girls in the higher pursuit of chastity, benevolence, and filial piety. After all, went the prevailing wisdom, learning unanchored by sound moral teachings was at best useless and at worst dangerous. Though honored as their teacher, Umi, educated, unmarried, earning her own keep, was hardly a model for her high-born students to emulate. Sutemitsu, Shige, and Umi had accomplished a great deal since being uprooted and transplanted all over again. Largely forgotten by the government that had sent them abroad, they had preserved their sense of duty and made significant strides towards fulfilling it, despite Japan's growing ambivalence towards Western ways. But despite all this, they remained anomalies, Umi most of all. On the holiday celebrating the Emperor's birthday that November, citizens of her rank were required to pay their respects at court, a privilege Umi had craved since her return to Japan, and to which she looked forward with nervous anticipation. But aside from Mrs. Shimoda, who was as a former lady-in-waiting fell into a different category, Umi was the only woman of her bureaucratic rank. It would not do to have an unaccompanied woman among the men at the imperial audience. So they asked me privately, you see, not to come, for they would not know what to do with me, Umi told Mrs. Landman, covering her disappointment with a show of relief. On the appointed day, when her colleagues went to the palace, Umi had the day off. Far nicer than to have to bow one's head off at court, she insisted staunchly. The next 3 years passed swiftly for the trio, the regular rhythm of the academic year punctuated by the excitement of new babies. Shige doubled the size of her brood to 4 on top of her teaching schedule. Sutemitsu had a second child, which, with her 3 stepdaughters, brought her total to 5, and found herself increasingly in the spotlight as her husband's star continued to rise. Umi, secure at last in her prestigious teaching position and free of parental cares, had begun to enjoy herself. Her letters preoccupied with gossip and social events. A cholera epidemic ravaged Tokyo in the summer of 1886, but Mrs. Landman was not to worry, as very few of the better classes catch it. the news that cholera had claimed the life of Ryo Yoshimasu, eldest of the original Iwakura girls, filled just half a paragraph. Ryo had married and born a child, but beyond that, Ume knew little, except that she lived in reduced circumstances. The trio had not kept up with her old friend. She seemed so different and changed, and we could not feel as we used to do, so we have lost sight of her, Ume wrote. It is very sad to think that this is the end of poor Ryo. Ume's letters revealed a consciousness caught between cultures. She identified as a Japanese, but thought more like an American. When Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado opened in London and New York to great acclaim, she was full of righteous indignation. Just suppose if on the Japanese stage in one of the Tokyo theaters, Queen Victoria and the British royal family were made the subject of a ridiculous play, she fumed to Mrs. Landman. Why, the British representative would soon appeal for redress and make a great fuss. But her outrage was undermined by curiosity. Can't you send me the libretto of it just for fun? That same fall, Japan was convulsed over the Normanton incident, in which a British cargo steamer en route from Yokohama to Kobe ran aground and sank. The 24 Japanese passengers drowned, while the foreign captain and crew were saved. The British captain claimed that the victims, being Japanese, had not understood his exhortations in English to board the lifeboats. The Japanese press howled, and anti-foreign sentiment exploded. I sent you a newspaper containing some accounts of the matter, which is indeed very curious, wrote Ume to Mrs. Landman. But on to more important news. She had gotten a raise and a promotion in rank, and the emperor's mother had invited the whole school to see Giuseppe Chiarini's Royal Italian Circus, then visiting Tokyo. Ume seemed somewhat oblivious to her compatriots' increasing wariness of foreign influence. When Prime Minister Ito hosted Japan's first costume ball at the Rokumeikan in April of 1887, Ume was pleased to receive an invitation and dazzled by the scene. Old emperors waltzing with peasant girls and Dutch maidens, old daimos polkaing with the goddess of liberty, and a jinriksha man and a Japanese carpenter in the same set with Queen Elizabeth. But those outside Ito's charmed circle were disgusted by the display, not to mention the rumors that in the wee hours, Ito himself had seduced the pretty young wife of one of his counselors. The evening would come to be seen as a turning point in Japan's cultural history, the moment when the love affair with Western fashions soured for good. The fancy ball made a great stir, and some of the newspapers made fun of the whole affair, Ume reported blithely. Still, it was a great success, and everyone who went enjoyed it. The following summer, Ume left her parents' home and moved closer to the school with a widowed cousin who also taught there, a decision at once pragmatic and symbolic, confirming Ume's determination to remain independent. Her new household included the cousin's small niece and Ume's little sister Fuki, a Purus's student. The arrangement was congenial enough, though in quiet moments Ume betrayed the wistful longing that lurked always near the surface. I love to think of you two, the same unchanged couple sitting by the fire in your own cozy room, just as I left you, she wrote to the Landmans that winter. Someday, when you are least expecting it, I will come in upon you and find you in your old places, and I will take mine between you. With Shige and Sudamatsu pouring their energies into motherhood, Ume had little opportunity to unburden herself to a kindred spirit. Though proud of her job, Ume was less than enthralled by her daily responsibilities. I have received notice to go to school, she wrote at the beginning of her second year, and though the lessons do not begin until the first of the month, we teachers must go a week ahead of time. There, we must decide our lessons, the hours, and make all the arrangements, which are too bothersome. She was unimpressed by the intellectual caliber of her highborn students, hampered as they were by the prescribed habits of their class and gender. The girls of the nobility are stupid as a rule, she wrote, and on another occasion, I wonder if these human dolls can learn much. Job security had not dispelled her underlying ambivalence about having a job in the first place. It's far from easy work to go from class to class and room to room, doing the same thing over and over again, and teaching the same things, although, you know, I'm very fond of teaching and enjoy school very much indeed. Her school bore little resemblance to the ones she had attended in Washington. Hirobumi Ito had become Japan's first prime minister in December 1885 and named Arinori Mori his minister of education. But their forward-thinking idealism and Sudamatsu's Vassar-inspired input notwithstanding, the Purus's school was a strikingly conservative institution. Mrs. Shimoda, as directress, came to school each day in traditional court dress, and most of the students, ages 6 to 18, dressed in kimonos with purple hakama, the flowing skirt-like trousers worn on formal occasions. In addition to Japanese, Chinese literature, English or French, and history, the girls studied morals, calligraphy, drawing, sewing, tea ceremony, flower arrangement, household management, and formal etiquette. Instruction in arithmetic ceased once they reached their teens. Most of the students arrived by jinriksha, the back of each conveying an emblazoned with a family crest, often followed by another carrying a maid. Maids and jinriksha men waited at the school all day to escort their charges home again. With enrollment growing and English taught daily in the 6 higher grades, Ume was increasingly busy. By the end of the second year, it was decided that the school would hire a foreigner to join the English department. But while Ume was eager to share her teaching load, the idea of a newcomer irked her. The school had recently hired a French woman who was paid more than Ume for fewer hours. That was a passage from Janice P. Nomura's book, Daughters of the Samurai. It's a real-life account of 5 young girls who were sent by the Japanese government to the United States in the late 19th century to learn the customs of the Americans and come back to Japan to teach them to a new society that was under a huge amount of change. It's really a tale of third culture that's been impressed upon these young girls, and then a third culture that they experience when they come back to their home country that now feels alien to them. Thank you for listening to The Big Snore. Until next time.